purpose of today's experiment is to prove that the object behind me, the lesser glass, is home to an observable, predictable, supernatural force. There's no scientific equivalent for the word haunted, so we'll just say this object is responsible for at least 45 deaths in the 4 centuries of its recorded existence.
Hello, and welcome to the monologue. My name is Cecilia Talbert. I'm joined by my co-hosts.
I'm Riley.
I'm Kelf.
Here at the monologue, we are here to explore the Flaniverse, and we're doing that through a thematic deep dive into the works of Mike Flanagan, exploring reoccurring motifs, creative processes, and collaborations in the Flaniverse. Hello, welcome.
Hello, welcome back, guys.
Welcome back.
Episode 2, what are we talking about?
So episode 2 is going to be all about the art of fear, redefining horror.
I chose this little monologue that Kaylee, the character in Oculus, gives, because I think it's very parallel with the way that Flanagan uses scares in horror. And I think the films that we're talking about today specifically are earlier works. So Oculus, Hush, and Absentia will probably be the main focus. But I feel like those three films especially are very focused thematically on isolation and dread. And I think that is such a reoccurring thing in Mike's work, even today, that I just think it's a really good place to start.
Yeah, and all three of those things kind of build. It starts off fairly normal. Like, Hush starts off just cooking in the kitchen in Absentia. Well, it does start off with her going around the neighborhood, but we don't really know anything about the situation yet. And then in Oculus, we meet this, like, brother and sister, but we don't get to really, like, the gruesome details until... So it kind of adds to it until it gets to, like, the crescendo of, like, the chaos.
Oh, mystery. That's really the, I think, theme that I was missing as well, is there's a very good mystery built in a lot of these. And a lot of it is unanswered by the end of the film. So I think there's a lot of ambiguity in the horror as well. And actually, what I would like to do before we, like, go on into talking about those movies, I just want to know, because we're all very familiar with Mike Flanagan's work, what is, like, one scare in any of his shows or films that has, like, stuck with you the absolute most?
I've got one.
You've got one? You
yes.
Can go ahead. Well,
all right.
Cecilia, thanks.
The, like, I think gnarliest scare is actually from Oculus, so it's fitting that we're talking about that today. The scene with the apple, where Kaylee's walking around the house, and she's snacking on an apple, and the mirror that's been established messes with your mind, and so she thinks that she's biting into the apple, but then it's, like, suddenly she's bitten into the light bulb, and the first time that I saw that, I was like, oh my god, that's, like, oh, that just creeped me out so much.
Yeah, especially as someone with, like, teeth trauma, that's very upsetting.
Teeth trauma is, like, a big thing in, like, nightmares and stuff like that. So it's, everybody has, like, a visceral reaction to that.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to think of, like, what my most memorable is. I think it's everything. I think it may be just because I've been recently rewatching Haunting of Hill House, but, like, everything with Nell. Like,
yeah.
There's this thing that Mike Flanagan does repeatedly where, like, it'll be a face that, like, morphs, and that stuff always gets me. So, like, even that first episode where his name just escaped my head, the older brother comes back, Steven, and he turns around and she's there. Watching back from Hill House, just all the ghosties you don't see in your first time. That always gets me a lot. It's just so creepy.
Oh, yeah, I love it that. Because there is, it, like, lingers in the background and you almost don't know why you feel so uneasy.
Yeah.
It just adds, like, an extra sense of dread, because whenever there's one scene. I think it's like Shirley when she's like walking and she's about to go outside, and then Nell's gonna follow her outside. There's like a ghost that's just standing in the window, just staring at you, and it's like that feeling of uneasiness, just like in Hush when she like finally like realizes like, oh, the door's open, and she sees the masked man just kind of standing there. Like the thought of someone watching you when you don't know about it is just so creepy.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's just the things that you aren't seeing. Like if you were those characters in that position, once you finally realize, that is so terrifying. Just how long has this been going on without my knowledge? Also, if anyone is interested, mine is in Doctor Sleep. And it's I guess, is it a dream sequence that Danny has that the woman that he's like hooking up with in the beginning,
it's a dream.
Yeah, you see like her and the little boy, speaking of the like face morphing, and like they are clearly very dead, and it's more of like this lingering thought that Dan is haunted by, that's like, well, what if when I left, that is what happened? And I think there's just a lot of tension and a lot of dread that is in these works.
Speaking of dread, from a literary perspective, it's called dramatic irony. So it's when the audience knows something that the character doesn't. And like Flaniverse things are just filled with dramatic irony. There's so many times where a character won't notice something, but we as the audience will, and we'll be like, oh no, like look out, or like, oh no. But then the character doesn't realize it, and then they walk right into it.
I think that, yeah, The Haunting of Hill House, that first episode, sets that up so incredibly well, because we know what has happened to Nell at that point. So when you see Steven interacting with this ghost, it's just that much more frightening, because you know that she has passed, but you don't know what these intentions are, and you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, there is that. That's such a good scare when he comes back and she's in there, and like, even the audience, you don't know yet, because the last thing we saw of Nell was she answered the phone call from her dad, and then Steven picks up the phone, and his dad goes, you know, Nell is dead. And as an audience, you go, what?
Oh, and then you see her face, and the, like she turns red in the mouth. Yeah. Ooh, and the eyes.
Yeah. It's so good.
God, I would hate to be Victoria Pedretti in that show, because I feel like half the time she's just covered in, like, creepy corpse makeup.
But it was an iconic part, so you gotta do what you gotta do.
Oh, yeah, and she does.
Yeah, I think one of the other really strong suits with all these movies, for the most part, which I think speaks to the suspense that Flanagan's able to build, is that most of these are pretty much like one location movies. Like, there's a little bit of variety here and there, but for the most part, they take place in one location, and that's so hard.
Oh, yeah. Oh, actually, okay, so that is a pretty good segue into, you guys want to go all the way back and talk about Absentia, which was made basically in an apartment building and a tunnel?
That's the first thing I was thinking. Like, in Absentia, the one location is out of necessity, but then it works really well. And so then in Hush and in Oculus, we get the same thing.
Yeah, it's a lot for very limited space.
Which that tunnel is actually, it's still there. Like, it wasn't created for the movie, it just exists. Have either of you guys been to it?
No, I have
no,
not.
But I could drive there. It's in Glendale. I just
made
my way over there.
I drove by it. I mean, obviously I didn't get out and walk it because I didn't want to be like that much of like a weirdo tourist, but I drove by it, and it looks creepy in person too.
I believe it. You throw Doug Jones in a tunnel, that is a recipe for horror.
Yeah, I think it also speaks so much to human nature. We all have things in our lives, both as kids and adults, that are just so mundane, but your brain just spins them into something terrifying. We all have irrational fears. I think there is something very terrifying about tunnels where it's claustrophobic and you're underground. So the idea that there might be something in there is a very common phobia.
That kind of sums up the whole idea of Absentia also, because it's more about what you don't see. It's like your brain is conjuring up these things, but you don't actually see it. So it's almost scarier because you can imagine something way more terrifying than anything that they could have like created for the screen.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's like Lovecraftian in that way, that it's almost like unthinkable, unimaginable horrors that, you know, if I saw a silverfish monster man, they're like, okay, fine. But if you tell me to imagine that, it's going to be 10 times more fucked up.
Similar to like the Jaws effect, right? Where it's like kind of out of necessity. I'm sure Mike Flanagan, I think he had $70,000 to make this, which is not a lot to make a movie. Like, you can't really show the monster. Like Jaws, the monster wouldn't work. So it actually ends up more terrifying, the fact that you can't see it.
Yeah, that, I mean, it was out of necessity, but it worked really well. It makes me think of, I'm probably going to butcher this. Is it like trypophobia, where people are afraid of holes and stuff like that. And the holes themselves. It's like the fear of what might be inside of them. So that, and that's like a really common, I see like probably more trigger warnings for that on social media than I do for anything else. So the concept of like a horror movie where you don't see something, but you know something is terrifying, that kind of ties into that as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I think with that, especially in absentia, because it was so low budget and because the scares had to be very creative, there's this like lingering effect that like, if you focus on something for so long, your brain is going to like start to play tricks on you and it's going to just increase that tension. And I think that's been something featured very heavily in all of Mike's stuff. I mean, obviously there are jump scares. There are a couple in absentia that I think are done really well that still get me every time. But it is very
Mike Flanagan
to not rely on that.
Yeah, Mike Flanagan just does ghosts like supremely well. I think all of the, is it Daniel the husband? All of his like ghosty scares are just, they still like really hold up. I feel like they both hint at the ghosts being her guilt, but also like, is there a sense of like maybe it is him reaching out from the underground?
I think it is. Like, I think because you can see like the, I remember like the hand trying to reach through in the tunnel.
I think it would definitely make sense. I don't know. You know what? Okay, so we talked about this a little bit in our first episode, but absentia is based or taken from the idea of the like Billy Goat's Gruff. I know this is a children's story, but I've never read it. I don't understand what it is. Does anyone know? Kelsey, you're an English teacher, please help me.
I actually had a student, I was subbing second grade and a student picked that in the library.
Oh.
So I think in the, we didn't get through the whole story, but I think in the original, there's like a troll under a bridge and he's like tricking the goats to like go under. I'm sure I'm oversimplifying this somehow, but so that would kind of be like the entity that's in the tunnel and he's kind of like capturing these people. And then I'm not sure, I know the offering that Katie Parker's character makes probably ties into that somehow, but I don't remember seeing that in the book. But again, we didn't get through the whole book, so.
God, that is an extremely bleak children's book.
A lot of them are, like Coraline is a children's book that is very bleak. Horrible. Yeah, there's so many like creepy like kids horror things out there.
I mean, you look at the Germans, just read any of them Grimm fairy tales. They just really like to scare their kids into behaving well.
Well, did it work?
What do you mean, did it work?
I don't know. How's Germany doing?
Probably better than we are.
Yeah, I'm sure it worked. Maybe we should try that next.
At least they got the Nazis out of there and they sent them to us, so.
Oh, great. Yeah, we made our own. God, speaking of horror.
Speaking of, like, the unknown, I think not only the unknown of, like, what lies in the tunnel, what may lie underneath, like, if there are, like, if it is Lovecraftian and it's, like, the old ones, I think the idea of just the idea of isolation and Daniel being missing and the idea of absentia, Trisha being pregnant but not really able to be with the guy because she's isolating herself because of her husband that has gone missing, and Kaylee being isolated because of her addiction. Everyone kind of in this movie especially suffers this like level of isolation, like even as far as like Jamie's character, who is like the neighborhood weirdo who keeps bringing animals to the tunnel.
Which I can completely understand why they think that character is a serial killer and is, you know, whatever to blame. But it's like deeply sad because he just wants to like see his dad.
That sense of isolation might be what connects all of the three movies that we're looking at today, because definitely like you pointed out in Absentia, but then also in Oculus, because Kaylee the sister?
Yeah.
Kaylee and is isolated in that she's like so obsessed with the finding out the history of this mirror. And then the brother was in jail, and so he's isolated there. And then in Hush, like Maddie is like literally isolated in the middle of nowhere, and she's deaf and mute, and so she can't communicate in the same way that other characters can.
Well, and even with her character, what I find very interesting is she's also choosing to isolate herself. Like with Oculus and with Absentia, the main characters in that have basically had something happen to them that has put them in this predicament. Like Tim especially is, if you have seen Oculus, is manipulated so badly by the laser glass that like he's a kid. He did not choose to have this, and then was isolated because he is incarcerated. I just find that very interesting, and I also think the biggest difference between Absentia and Oculus compared to Hush is the tone of the ending. And I think you can definitely see when Mike and Kate start collaborating with each other more, things begin to get a lot more optimistic in these endings.
Goes from being very bleak, there's almost no hope. Although I think there might be something in Absentia that I can't tell if it's like a fool's hope. There is something, especially about like the more recent like Mike Flanagan endings they're just very bittersweet. Like, yes, you're kind of emotionally wrecked, but there is like an element of hope to cling on to.
I think that's something that horror needs more of, because I don't know, there's just, it doesn't feel as fulfilling without like empathy and hope. And I feel like that's just something that the horror community has a lot of, and it's nice to see reflected in that work.
There is sometimes it is nice to, well, not nice, nice is probably not the right word, but sometimes it is entertaining to have that ending where it's like, oh, there's no hope. And then it makes you examine like humanity as a whole, kind of like Stephen King's Revival. Like if all of his stories ended that way without any hope and everything being super bleak, like that probably would be depressing and you wouldn't want to read all of them. But because that doesn't happen all the time, like the unexpectedness of it is kind of like, wow, like I know this is awful. And it's like you get to, you think more than when there's like an ending, a happier ending, like with Hush. How are we spoiling endings for this?
Oh yeah,
spoilers.
Okay, spoilers. Right. I feel like if people are listening, they've seen
okay it. Like with Hush, in the ending, it is more hopeful. And so it's kind of like, okay, that's nice. But with Oculus and Absentia, it's like, whoa, what did I just watch? And it kind of makes you think more. So even though the hopefulness in horror, yes, like that is nice. But at the same time, I think that we need those bleak endings sometimes to contrast.
I feel like, speaking of bittersweet endings, does anyone else view Oculus like that? Like, I know it's very intense and it's very, okay, hear me out. Hold on. They're giving me looks. I feel like I consider it to be bittersweet because before Kaylee obviously gets smashed with the yacht anchor, she kind of proves that she was right. And that, like, kind of, I don't know, vindicates Tim in a way. Like, obviously things don't go well for him at the end, but it is almost like a, oh, okay, I didn't just murder my dad for no reason, and, like, you know, I'm not a bad person. This actually was happening. At least that's the way that I choose to view it.
It did prove that he was right, but, like, not to the police or anybody, so he's
vindication.
Yeah, so I don't know how he would feel, like, he's going back to prison, and I don't know if he's gonna be in prison, like, oh, this is fine, because I was right, or if he's gonna, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how he would feel.
Yeah, and his sister's dead, and his whole family. All right, maybe...
So he's really isolated by the end of it, because, like, the mirror has, like, isolated him from everybody. Not only is he in prison, but he has, like, no contacts on the outside.
Well, at least he can get
everyone's
the fuck
dead
away from the mirror.
I don't know why. I definitely really enjoyed Oculus, but I really don't like the ending, and I don't know what it is, because maybe it's I'm just mad because I'm just like, Tim was just trying to live his life. Like, Kaylee dying, that makes perfect sense. Like, someone who can't move on from a childhood trauma and just keeps, like, is stuck in that cycle and refuses to try to get themselves out of it. Like, that's probably what's going to happen to you, but I just feel so bad for Tim.
I know, because it would be one thing if, like, if he was able to, like, maybe get away or something, and then, because, yeah, definitely, like, she is obsessing about the past, she's stuck, so now she's, like, physically stuck there, like, she can no longer, her life does not extend past that, but poor Tim, he, like, didn't even want to go back to the mirror, and she kind of, like, manipulates him into it, and then the mirror manipulates him into taking the fall, so it's, like, this poor guy.
The first time I watched Oculus, I didn't really like it a lot. I really liked it this time, but I have a lot of problems.
Okay.
With the movie?
And I think it comes down to the fact that even rewatching it, I'm like, this reminds me so much of Hill House. Ooh. Like, there's so many elements he...
Hill House is 10 hours.
Yeah, wasn't out yet.
That's the thing. I'm like, I'm wondering if I would have liked this more if it had been either, like, a three-part miniseries or a show. Because everything just felt, like, really fast to me, to the point of where I'm just like, man, I really just wish I was watching Hill House, because, like, it's so well paced and you really get to know the characters, and it's not like the mom is, like, just possessed by the mirror and she's crazy. But I mean, visually, and, like, the way it's direct, it's mine comes down to, like, writing for the most part, and that's the limits of having a feature length film. But, like, visually, it's stunning.
I think that there was supposed to be more to Oculus. I think things were cut. I know for sure that I'm blanking on her name. I know it starts with an M. Kate's character in Oculus.
Marisol.
She was supposed to have a whole scene in, like, she appeared to be alive with the dad. And I know that was cut. So it makes me wonder, were there other things that were cut that kind of gave the characters backstory? So I agree with you that as, like, a mini series or something, I feel like it would have been, we would have gotten more depth to the characters. Like, you're limited when it's a movie because it can only be so long.
Have
either of you watched the Oculus short film?
I know. Really like it. It's good.
Do you? I feel like I'm on... maybe I should watch it again.
I think for, like, clearly the budget they had, the fact that it's, like, a one-room thing, I think they give you just enough. You know, it's a short going in, that I thought it was really well done. I really liked it. And a lot of it makes it into the Oculus movie proper.
Do, like, you want to...
Straight dialogue.
Do you want to maybe talk about how that one is different, or kind of what's contained in that? Because I haven't seen the short version. I've only seen the feature film version. So I'm willing to bet that there's probably people listening who haven't seen it.
So the
short version, it's as opposed to Kaylee, who's leading the charge on this experiment, it's actually Tim's character who is. Kaylee, I think, is a character they probably made for the movie so that it wasn't just one person in a room by themselves for, like, an hour and a half. So it is just him. It's him in one room. It's all using footage that's, like, from his camera. So it's very found footagey. And it's very similar to that beginning where Kaylee's just running through the people, how they died, the mirror, talking about the mirror's effects, what it does. And as opposed to the movie where Kaylee, which I think this is really dumb, the fact that she says this all in front of the mirror, I think that's what drove me crazy as someone who should have known better. The fact that she says from the beginning that, like, I have a kill switch on you, whereas in the short, he's like, I just want to prove to the world that I'm not crazy. And so the mirror has less of a reason to really want to kill him up until the point in the short where he says, I'm going to kill you. And then things ramp up because the mirror's like, I'm in danger. Whereas I guess in the film, it's more of the mirror hasn't been eating. So it doesn't have the power yet to kill them. But I'm like, as soon as it does, it's going to kill you. You said you're going to kill it. So.
Well, and that's the thing is Kaylee is like, lined up all these plants and she's got this dog and her and Tim are
really smart
in, well, but it's like, oh, you're basically just feeding the mirror now. Okay, well, clearly things aren't gonna go great.
Yeah, what do you think about Kaylee's plan, Kelsey?
I mean, I can see her from her perspective why she might think that would be a good idea, because then that would kind of give it smaller things to feed on instead of going right for her and Tim. But And I'd never really considered it from your perspective, but now that I do, that does make a lot of sense. Because I wonder if she hadn't brought in the plants and the dog and all those other arrangements, if the mirror, if it couldn't feed, then maybe it wouldn't have had the energy to mess with them as much as it did.
I get the idea of the plants and the dog, though, because the plant, she wants to give it enough power so it can do something, the dog to make it disappear, and that's probably in her mind is like, that's going to be my proof. The same thing happens in the short. But I just, them knowing how powerful the mirror is, and then them just like, I have all these things that I can easily be tricked out of, that I'm just like,
this is a 10-year grudge against this movie, by the way, because I remember the first time you saw it, because I kept getting ads for it, so I was very interested to find out what you thought, and I just remember you being like, I hated it.
I definitely think my opinion on it has changed. I think my qualms with Kaylee as a character haven't changed much, but I definitely see her different now as someone who's clearly dealing with trauma and thinks they're doing something that's incredibly smart, but no. Not really.
You know what's really interesting that I just realized? It's Absentia and Oculus are kind of mirroring each other in that way, because Kaylee like refuses to let go of this trauma, and then it's Trisha, right? That's Courtney Bell's character. She has finally gotten to the point where she's like, okay, I've accepted that my husband has disappeared. We'll declare him dead in absentia, thus the name of the film. And it's just so interesting to see, like, I don't know, those two characters in such different mindsets, but really coming to kind of the same end.
Yeah, they are kind of similar. Like, you could think of Kaylee is refusing to let go, just like Kaylee in Oculus, and then Tim would be like Trisha, who is just kind of like over it. Yeah, so it is kind of, it's almost like Mike took Absentia and like the characters in that and the motivations in that, and it's like, but what if we like explored it more in like a, I don't know, like a with a more clear antagonist, because in Absentia it's like really not clear for a while like what is causing all this and what is happening, but in Oculus it's like, it's the mirror, you know right away it's the mirror.
Oh yeah, it's way less of a mystery, it's just kind of proving to everyone else that like this mirror is evil without seeming completely insane, which, you know, clearly doesn't happen.
Yeah, and I think it's Kaylee's hubris, too, that, like, she has the mirror. She could have just destroyed it. She didn't have to go through all the hassle of, like, filming it and setting up this elaborate thing. So, but she decides to because she wants to prove to the world that she and her brother aren't crazy. But instead, what she does is, because she decides to go through this elaborate thing, she just feeds the mirror again.
God, what a cycle. And now we got that mirror showing up every single other movie. So, I don't know. I feel like maybe there's a connection. Maybe that mirror's driving everyone
crazy. It's a fun Easter egg, for sure.
I love how it's always every time something new comes out, it's like, where was the last glass? You have to find out where the last glass was in this new thing.
Oh man, that's so fun. Finding, oh god, the Lazar Glass and then Pope Incognito are my two favorite Easter eggs.
Is the Lazar Glass in Hush?
I was actually just about to ask the same thing.
Because I can visualize where it is in all the other ones, but I'm not sure about that one.
Google it.
Yeah, still you find out.
While I Google it, do we want to talk about, I think something that Mike has talked about, especially is the, I think up and probably until like, Fall House of Usher, like not using excessive gore has been kind of one of Mike's trademarks. He does use gore, but I think he had something really eloquent to say about it, which is once you use too much gore, horror fans will turn off their brain and start admiring the gore as opposed to feeling for a character. So I think that's really interesting. How do you guys think in these three movies Mike uses gore in a way that helps the story without distracting from the story?
I think the answer is honestly just shock value, especially in absentia, because I don't know if it's even considered gore, but the offering that is left is, how do I say this?
Are you talking about the end?
I'm talking about the end, and I'm talking about a fetus, sure. I guess.
Yeah, it's, you know, Kaylee's character runs into the tunnel to get her, not Kaylee, oh my gosh, wait, is it Kaylee? How many Kaylees are there?
Yeah, because that's Kaylee's character's name in absentia, right?
And it's also the character in Oculus as well. Yeah.
Okay,
the same names a lot of the time.
The name Kaylee just keeps popping up. I don't know what it is about, if there's a thing with Kaylee.
You know what? I want to ask Mike if there's a thing with Riley's, because that's my name, but that's their last name. And then we've got Riley and Midnight Mass, and I feel like there's got to be somebody else. And then a lot of Jamie's pop up, but I feel like that's pretty easy to figure out. That's sibling.
Well, and in Usher, they're Poe characters, so where the names come from. And in Hill House, most they're either characters from the Shirley Jackson book, or like Shirley is just straight up like using Shirley.
Steven's Spielberg, right?
That I'm not sure, but that wouldn't surprise me.
I think it is. I'll
or check. King.
Oh yeah. Oh, it could be. Yeah, either.
Sorry, I zoned out. I was reading this thing about the mirror. Apparently, according to this Redditor, the only movies it doesn't appear in are Before I Wake and Hush.
Okay,
I don't know if this Redditor is correct.
That
but,
would make
that's
sense because Before I Wake, I believe, was filmed before Oculus. It just came out after.
Was in like release hell
limbo
for a
long time. So that
because
would make
of
sense.
The studio going what? Bankrupt. Yeah.
That would make sense that it's not in there. And then from a production perspective, maybe it's not in Hush because they shot in Alabama and that was also a fairly low budget movie. And so maybe it just wasn't.
I feel like it would just be
enough to travel it all the way out there.
Yeah, it'd just be kind of hard to fit into the aesthetic of Maddie's house too. Because it does just look like a random, you know, house in the middle of the woods, and that just would be very jarring as a decoration.
Yeah, which I mean, it is like it was just someone's house in Alabama that they just moved into to film. So,
well, and I wonder too because a lot of Maddie's character is like she can't hear, so she does not see this guy walking around the house. If the mirror was there, she could have easily just been like, "Oh, hey, that guy's in the reflection."
That's actually a good point. There's not.
Now that I think
about it, I don't think there's any mirrors that we see in Hush because that would take away the dramatic irony because she'd be like, wait a second.
Yeah, she'd just be like, I can see you. I'm calling the cops.
Also, if they're shooting in a real house, it's really hard to shoot with mirrors around. So maybe it was both like, oh, it makes sense for both the story standpoint and a filming standpoint. Because I think they didn't have a lot of time to film Hush either. Like, it was really, like, really tight, short project.
I think it was over the span, don't quote me, but I think it was over the span of like 2 weeks, I think.
Oh,
maybe
wow.
Less than 2 weeks.
I think so.
It was yeah. Fast.
It's impressive. But that, speaking of that too, there's really the only things I can think of gore-wise in terms of Hush are the hands. There's always a hand. And
the leg.
Samantha Williams' character, like her dead body just being like propped up against that window, is one of the most horrifying parts of that movie to me.
Just the knocking on the window.
Oh my god, the limp hand is just, I'm a corpse.
And it serves a purpose too, like Maddie's hand being mangled, because then later when she's trying to load the crossbow, that would explain why she's struggling with it because of the hand. And then she does have that wound in her leg as well, but those are the only two. Like, there's not an excessive amount of blood.
Yeah, and Kate Siegel talks about it in a, I watched an interview where she said, as someone who, you know, is deaf, just hurting their hands, their method of communication, is isolating. So I'm like, well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
That would be like mouth trauma or something for someone who speaks.
I feel like that there almost always is a purpose or a reason. Like, when I think of gore now, especially that quote that you said of Mike's about, like, horror fans admiring it when there's so much, it just makes me think of like the Terrifier films, because if you do zone out and you just think like, oh wow, Damien Leone is a really, really great effects guy, it becomes way less scary. But I think just the possibility and the like anticipation that builds with all of those like gore and harm scenes being so far and like few and in between, I don't know, it just creates so much more tension for me as a viewer, rather than like, oh, cool, another, you know, rat down the throat scene, great.
It takes you out of the story, too. Like, I was still teaching middle school when Halloween Kills came out, and all the middle school boys were like, did you see it? And I was like, yeah, like, what did you think? And they were just like, oh, there was that one moment, and oh yeah, or this kill scene, and oh my god, all the blood, all the guts. So it kind of, I think what he was trying to say in that interview is it takes you away from, like, the storyline and the characters, and you're just like, oh, that was a cool kill scene, or oh, that was some gnarly gore. And so you're just kind of almost in middle school boy mode, like, oh yeah, awesome, as opposed to following the movie.
Yeah, it's the difference between a slasher and a thriller.
Well, I think that's something that slashers do wrong all the time, is you need to care about the characters for it to matter that they keep getting slaughtered. And I think Halloween Kills is a great example of what not to do. I love the Halloween reboots, but They're not great. They don't do a great job with character development. Stop.
Yeah, which again, I mean, everyone that I know that has anything to do with film or criticizing film or anything didn't like them. The only people that I know who did were, again, my middle school students.
Middle school students and Cecilia and I.
Well, okay. The story wasn't awful, but again, there's so much gore that it takes you out of it, and it's very much a bro, like, yeah.
Yeah, you don't go to see those movies for like thought provoking conversation.
You see them for fascination.
Yes.
It's like that meme, like, where people are like, I watched this show for the plot, and then you swipe, and the plot is just, like, because an actor is really hot or something. Like, you go see those for the plot, in which the plot is, like, the gore.
The plot is, like, Michael Myers stabs people. Okay.
Yeah, which is not, that's, like, the complete opposite of, like, a Mike Flanagan thing. You do watch a Mike Flanagan project for the plot.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's why this community is so much more thoughtful. But I do think there's a fun balance, because obviously Follow the House of Usher is just a gore fest. But I feel like there's a good balance in all of the things Mike does as well, because there are moments in that show that made me absolutely sob.
And in the defense of Fall of the House of Usher, the gore in that is in the stories as well. Yes. Like, the stories are terrifying and bloody and gory. So a lot of that was the source material. So it wasn't, like, when people were like, oh my god, like, he's showing that he hates cats because of, like, the black cat episode. And it's like, that's in the story. Poe like, wrote that. Yeah.
The cat survives in Hush.
He does. The cat survives.
Usher, too, though. Like, that's the one thing they changed.
Oh, yeah. The cat does survive.
Leave that man alone. He does not need cats. Unless he does, I don't speak for him.
I keep thinking of that there was some interview that he did talking about Dr. Sleep, and I think this is where the hates cats reputation came from, because he was talking about Azzy, I think is the name of the cat, that sits on the beds of the patients that are going to be passing away. And he said that it was so hard to film with that cat because the actors would be doing a great emotional job and the shot would be like perfect. And then the cat would be like, oh, it's time for me to chase my tail, or now it's time for me to lick my butt or something. And so the cat messed up so many shots and they had to refilm because, so I think he probably was like, oh, that cat. And then people were like, oh my God, he hates cats.
No, I think you should leave it like that. I think that's more true to reality, that you're having like an emotional conversation and then the cat suddenly just got its asshole in your face.
I mean, then that would almost be like excessive gore. It would take you out of the emotional moment because you're like, what is this cat doing?
Honestly, I'd rather have the gore.
It's more of gore being used when it makes sense for the story, as opposed to, oh, this is a horror film. There should be gore.
Well, and I feel like, I don't know, I like that too. In the original works that Mike has, if you take out all of the horror, they're still just great stories. Like Oculus, Hill House, those are just really good family dramas. I understand that sometimes it is necessary, but it is nice just to know that like there is a great story underneath all of that.
Yeah, and I think that's where the elevation comes into it. It's that it's not just we're making this to make money, we're making this to scare you. It's like, no, we're going to tell you a really good story, and there's also going to be some scares in it.
Yeah, just using horror as a vehicle.
Like, I firmly believe that Hill House is, like, for everybody, even people that tell me they don't like horror. Because it's like, well, it's more of a drama with some horror elements that pop up. But there is enough story there that's not horror-related for everybody to really connect with that.
Well, and that's how I convinced my mom to watch, because I got her to watch Bly. Because I feel like that's a very easy one for non-horror fans to start with. But then it was, like, my mom, one of her favorite shows is 6 Feet Under. And it was like, well, it's that, basically, just with some ghosts.
Ghosts.
With even more ghosts, actually. Yeah. There's tons of ghosts on 6 Feet Under.
When you think of horror, I think you think of just blood and guts. Like, that's because that's my mom's thing. She always says she doesn't like horror, but what she means is she doesn't like gore. Mm-hmm. And so gore is not, like you said, Riley, earlier, like, you don't get gore for the sake of gore in the Flanniverse. You get gore when it's necessary to go with the story. Because, I mean, again, in Hush, it wouldn't be realistic if Maddie was, like, fighting for her life and did not get injured at any point. Like, that wouldn't be realistic. So the gore with the hand and with the arrow in her leg is necessary. But it's not, I guess, well, not traditional horror. Traditional is probably not the word, but it's not the kind of horror that people that think they don't like horror think of, where it's just excessive blood and excessive guts.
It's all very human, and it's all very relatable, even if these are situations you would never find yourself in. I feel like there's, I don't know, just something that everyone can kind of relate to in these stories. And that's kind of what horror is about. It brings people together.
It plays on kind of like those like more like primal fears, like the thought of like someone watching you when you don't know it. Someone that might be staring at you through a window when it's dark. Or the fear of like
isolation.
yeah, isolation or an Oculus, the whole idea of like questioning your sanity, like, is this really happening? Like, that would be scary if you feel like you're losing your grip on what's real and what's not.
I feel like modern horror especially has really started to use these themes to its advantage. And I feel like Mike and a lot of other modern directors like a Jordan Peele or Robert Eggers have been very influential. And I'm very excited to see how that evolves in future horror film series, books, whatever.
Yeah, because when it comes down to it, horror deals with topics that we all deal with. And it's a way to explore those themes in a safe way for the viewer. As you experience it through those characters, whether it's isolation, whether it's, you know, being stuck in a cycle of grief and trauma, especially given what the whole world went through, you know, 4 years ago and is still kind of recouping from. I think a lot of themes in all three of these films really kind of speak to what we all recently went through.
Oh, yeah. And I feel like horror does a very good job reflecting what society is like at the time that it's made. So it's also going to be really interesting to see in the next 4 years what goes on there.
I agree. I think horror lets us safely experience or kind of take our what ifs and have them play out in a fictional setting.
It's about catharsis, and that is what I love the absolute most about horror. And that is something that has made me a huge fan of Mike Flanagan and very excited to see what he does next.
And I think that's it for this week's episode of The Monologue. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.